This is a special message before the podcast you're about to hear. I have some bad news to report. The following cast you're about to listen to was recorded when Skype decided to adjust my audio settings without letting me know. And because of it, my voice was recorded using my webcam instead of my headset, which you should be hearing me right now. What that means is that not only are you going to be hearing background noise a lot more, but my voice is going to be heavily distorted. I really do apologize for that. I like to keep these casts to a level of quality, and this is going to be below that. Fortunately, I was able to catch it after two casts, but it's still two casts that are going to be messed up because of it. Anyway, just wanted to give you this brief announcement and to let you know what's going to happen. This problem should not happen again. I'm aware now of what the issue was, and I'll be sure to hopefully catch it if it ever happens again. Anyway, hope you enjoy the cast, regardless of the quality of my voice. Take care.
Good evening, everybody. This is Josh Pleiser from GameWisdom.com. Welcome to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast, where we examine the art and science of games. We got a great cast for you today. My guest is from the studio Abbey Games, who, even though they are on their second major release, both their titles have been incredibly imaginative and some of my favorites in recent years. Their first game, Ruse, was a very interesting take on strategy design and city building management, and their latest game, Renowned Explorers International Society, won my Best of 2015 award and has been a constant play on the Game Wisdom Twitch stream and YouTube channel. So let's welcome him to the cast. From Abbey Games, please welcome game designer Adrian Jansen.
Hello.
Adrian, it's a pleasure to have you on.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. I am excited to talk about games with you.
Yeah. I guess, first of all, definitely congratulations on Renowned Explorers. I spoke with Manuel about this on the Twitch stream. I think it was about a week or so ago from this recording. But I'm definitely enjoying it, and it sounds like the expansion has been at least picking things up for you guys.
Yeah, it certainly has. We're doing pretty well now with Renowned Explorers, and thanks a lot for the compliments. I've been following Game Wisdom as well, so it was nice to see us popping up regularly. It was an honor to be the Game of the Year of 2015.
Not a problem. And Renowned Explorers definitely deserves, at least from my point of view, it's just such a unique game, and we're going to be definitely spending some time on the cast talking about that later in.
That's great.
So to get the ball rolling, Adrian, since this is your first time on the cast, could you tell everyone listening a little bit about yourself and about Abbey Games?
All right. I am Adrian Jansen. I am the game designer at Abbey Games. We started Abbey Games. Abbey Games is a Dutch game studio in Utrecht. We started about 4 to 5 years ago. And our first game was Ruse, as you said, and then we made Renowned Explorers. We're all pretty young. I think I'm the oldest one, being 27. And we basically just wanted to start making games when we were studying. So we did that, and it turned out pretty good.
Now, one question for you, Adrian, is one I like to ask a lot of my international guests. What is, like, I guess, the state of the game industry for you guys in the Netherlands? Because as I'm reaching out to more of these international guests, it's always interesting to hear about how the industry is going in different parts of the world.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. The Netherlands have been pretty busy with trying to promote the development of more game studios. Mm-hmm. I have to say there are a few, like Guerrilla from Sony, from Killzone. That's a Dutch studio as well. That's the biggest one around. And then there are Vlambeer, which also a pretty well-known duo, who is also from Utrecht, and Ronimo from Swords and Soldiers and Awesome Knots, who is also from Utrecht. So it's a kind of a little bit of a indie hub over here. Aside from that, there are some smaller indie studios. Wispfire, which is making a pretty cool-looking game. But those are all smaller. And I think... Well, Triumph Studios is also another studio from the Netherlands who made Age of Wonders. Mm-hmm. But I think that's about the big names you probably know about. There are a few smaller studios, but it's not Sweden or something where there are tons of studios who are making big titles. It's a bit modest, to be honest, I think.
Okay.
But there is a lot of good infrastructure, and you get some nice help from some government instances. Not funds, but necessarily, but infrastructure. So sometimes they invite people over, and we can talk with them, like from from Valve or from Nintendo or those kind of parties. Mm-hmm. So that's how basically Epic Games also started. We got pretty close to the Dutch Game Garden, or inside of the Dutch Game Garden even, and that gives you a lot of opportunities. And we took advantage of them, I think.
How many people are currently working at Epic Games now?
Right at this moment, there are 7. Mm-hmm. As you know, the development of games is pretty... It requires a fluctuating amount of people.
Yeah.
So now we are about at our lowest. I think now we are at our lowest, partially because Renown Explorers had such a slow start, which was pretty heavy,
mm-hmm.
but also because we're not in bulk production right now. So we're now at 7, and I think the maximum we had was 15.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been between that.
Yeah, and that's something that's always interesting to hear about with the game industry. And I think that's something that people outside don't normally know, that most studios will grow and shrink depending upon the current scope of the project or what's going on.
Exactly.
And that's something I hear from a lot of other studios as well, especially a lot more of the independent spaces where you don't really have, you know, the budget to keep 20, 30 people on unless... you know, you are working 24/7 on a project.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not something that we want to do because it's really nice to have a core team,
mm-hmm.
but we don't have the opportunities yet to keep everyone on board all the time, and we also didn't have the funds to do that.
Yeah.
So yeah, you're absolutely right. It's a fluctuating thing, mm-hmm. and we try to minimize it, but it's still happening.
Yeah. One of the questions I have for you, Adrian, about the state of the game industry in the Netherlands. When I spoke with Rahul Sagal, who's in India, we talked sort of about the state of the market. He's mentioned about how they were really heavy in mobile game space, you know, free-to-play, stuff like that.
Yeah.
For you guys in the Netherlands, what, I guess, is like the current popular trend, if there is one? Like, do the majority of studios prefer PC? Do they like mobile, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, I think the studios I just mentioned are more for PC.
Mm-hmm.
Although, I must say, there are also quite some serious games studios and some very big mobile,
mm-hmm.
Casual type studios as well. I don't know very well what they're doing, but I think there are a few bigger players. But from the indie studios that are around, most go for PC.
Yeah, and it's interesting to hear that, Adrian, because when I, again, with Rahul, he just basically said that everyone was just mobile-centric. And that sort of led to the trouble he was having with pushing his game, Bird of Light, and eventually made him transition to the PC for the original release.
Yeah. I think an important factor in this for the Netherlands is that we had a few success stories for PC. So the examples that are around are Ranimo, Flambeer, and us. And that makes people follow more into our footstep, more looking at Steam. I think that's an important reason. If we would have a really successful mobile game development studio, more like in Finland, for example,
mm-hmm.
I think the things will be different.
Yeah. And that, again, that goes back to what I was saying a few minutes ago. It's always interesting to hear how the game industry really develops around the world. When
yeah.
I spoke with Mike Lee from Fake Dice in South Korea, he talked about, again, like the state of the mobile industry and how it was they were really pushing that, despite, of course, the esports popularity that has sort of been given birth in the South Korean space for the last...
yeah,
like 20 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
Now, getting back to Abbey Games, one of the things I find really interesting, especially about independent developers today compared to 15, 20 years ago with the state of most studios, is how much independent spaces generally diversify their games. Like in the past, ASU was basically known as the first person shooter studio or the strategy game studio, etc.
Yeah.
But one of the things I've seen a lot and one of the things I really do like about independent studios today is the fact that they just make a lot of diverse games. And Abbey Games is definitely no exception. When you look at Ruse versus Renown Explorers, they're just two completely different designs. You can never say that you can really see elements of Ruse and Renown and vice versa just because they're completely different. So my question for you, Adrian, is how would you, I guess, define the type of games you guys like to make at Abbey Games?
Ah, that's a great question. I think the most important thing that we are chasing is the idea of inserting new verbs into game space. To clarify that, Ruse, our first game, had a not necessarily a message. We're still finding ourselves a little bit there, but it had an idea about greed and balance as the most important mechanics and verbs that are around in the game. And that is a kind of a counterpoint towards like action or violence or those kind of things. Same goes for Renowned Explorers. Again, not necessarily a message, but more the idea of inserting the verbs of diplomacy in a new, more tactical and strategic layer. That is, for me, at the base of a lot of the design. Although I have to say that those are very risky, those moves, and you, it's something I will be more careful with in the future. And the other thing that we also really like is, well, as with indie games, there's a lot of the power from the indie games comes from the characters of the character of the people who make them. So, for example, the design, even though Reus, as we call it in the Netherlands, and Renowned Explorers are two very different games, they really have the blueprint that is the design I just talked about, which is something that's really close to me. And the art style is something else that you could compare pretty easily, Reus and Renowned Explorers. That is a blueprint from Marlies Barens, our artist. So I think those two things are the most defining points. But if you would talk about genre or what kind of actions or in what theme you fit, I think we don't really have that. It's more really the the higher meta level of game design that is more common for us.
And that's I think that's one of the things I am hearing more from independent studios, that they're basically establishing themselves as the brand as opposed to the games. And you made a really good point regarding the art style, which I also really enjoy from Ruse and Renowned Explorers. On the casts, or I'm sorry, on the streams all the times, I always love the little animations of the characters during the game. I think one of the things I just love was like the little sheep attacking you by doing their little joyful bounce up and down. And it does really have like a unique look to it. It sort of reminds me a lot of Clay Entertainment, who go for very stylized art styles, but their games are just completely different from one another. Don't Starve, Invisible Ink, etc.
It's complicated in a way because we're still kind of also finding ourselves. I think this is not something that we can keep up forever. You got to get really good at something at some point. And the idea of having like we really like games that make that are about thinking, so and the games with new verbs and messages, that's something that we're probably gonna go deeper into. We believe that games can be a really good force in your life. Something that you don't hear that often, that games can be good just like art or that kind of things, and that's something that we're probably gonna try to pursue, show people that games are good.
And that's always another very interesting and deep discussion we're having these days. I get to, again, date myself. I remember back in the late 80s through the 90s, and video games were, you know, considered the same thing as rock and roll and Dungeons and Dragons. You know, it was something for, not for mainstream. You were made fun of if you played a lot of video games, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then over the last decade, things have just really exploded in terms of the pop culture and significance, both for good and for bad with the game industry. We're seeing a lot more talks regarding becoming more inclusive to various people. There's, of course, the push and the talks for education, gamification, and just trying to, I think, really educate people on the benefits of video games as well as the philosophy of the design.
Yeah, this is a topic. I think we could fill a whole podcast about this.
Definitely.
But in short, to give a bit of my vision on it, I see games not necessarily yet at the point where you can really, as a general, look at them as art yet.
Mm-hmm.
Yet. there are a few exceptions. I think, for example, The Witness or Undertale are, I think, games as art.
Mm-hmm.
But because what I'm kind of missing is, and what's something that I really would like to pursue is the idea that games are a pleasurable way for you to learn something or remember you of being a good human being.
Mm-hmm.
And those things are a little bit rare. I mean, even really, really, really great games like GTA 5 or something, they tell you something. I think GTA 5 is really about the current zeitgeist, for example. But Undertale did something. I'm not talking about Undertale now. It's going to be way too long. But I would like to see games a bit more like a movie that when the movie's over, that you think like, wow, I'm inspired to do something better,
mm-hmm.
or to enjoy something more, or I don't know, call my parents and say I love them or something like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And games are not there yet, but that's something I think games can really get to, and not only in a narrative way, but also in the way of the actions you are doing. And that's something you're totally right that it started out something rebellious, and then it goes on and then becomes a mainstream form of entertainment, and now it is a mainstream form of entertainment, and now it's more to push towards something more meaningful. That's something I'm interested in, at least.
And that definitely is a good 2-hour conversation right there. I know we've been trying to explore this so many times on previous casts and articles as well. And that push between art and product is definitely something that needs to be talked more about, especially for new people entering the industry today.
I absolutely agree.
Because I've said this multiple times on posts and podcasts, I do believe the video game industry is as much an art as it is a business. You need to balance those two sides in order to really remain viable. But
yes,
I think one of the challenges that we're seeing, especially today, with more people asking these deeper questions about what can video games teach us? What can we emotionally feel from these games? And this is forcing developers, especially I think the independent space, who are in the position to really, I guess, explore these topics, is to figure out, how do I make a game like this, but still make something that, you know, will keep my studio in business?
Exactly. It's super interesting. I think in short, to give an example from the movies industry is a movie like The Life of Pi or American Beauty.
Mm-hmm.
Two great movies with a lot of entertainment value and blockbusters, but they really had something to tell, and that's kind of the point that I'm aiming at, but it's hard.
Yes.
And you have to take a lot of risks and those kind of things. So you're absolutely right that it is a big risk, and you have to really balance the business and the art to make something that lasts and make your studio last.
Yeah, and that is definitely the rub there. I mean, think about like the movie industry. And I was watching like these featurettes on like famous horror film directors like John Carpenter, David Cronenberg, and those people. And despite being very recognizable names who have achieved these, you know, cult statuses among their fans, they had a lot of trouble with their movies. Like, they had complete duds, even though a lot of people liked them. And again, it's that balance. You can make something artistically moving, something that people will talk about forever and ever, but could still be a complete commercial flop that could ruin your studio and bankrupt you and could get you blacklisted forever and ever.
Yeah, yeah, it's a tricky business, but yeah, we'll have to see where it goes. It's not something you can predict really well, but I'm excited to see where it goes.
Yep, definitely. Now, going back to Abbey Games and sort of your design philosophy of trying to introduce new verbs and basically trying to create new experiences, one of the challenges in noting that we see, especially from independent developers and even with major studios, is trying to properly balance and make these games appealing. One of the things that we see a lot in the AAA space is the fact that they rely on similar designs and similar verbs. We saw this in the 90s when pretty much it was platformer heavy. And then in the 2000s when it became first-person shooter heavy. And we're starting to see that again with now a lot of studios are trying to get into like the MOBA bandwagon. Stuff like Battleborn, Overwatch, and of course Dota and League of Legends.
Yep.
And I think we talked about this on a previous cast. The reason, of course, why developers do this is because they know this is a bankable idea. If Call of Duty makes millions of dollars, then that means people obviously won't play first-person shooters.
Exactly.
But with a studio like Abbey Games and with a lot of independent developers these days, when you are pushing for those unique designs, something that hasn't been seen before, how do you, I guess, go about answering this question? Is this game good? Is this something that people are going to enjoy? Because that is something that every independent developer, hell, every developer in the world has probably laid awake one night, you know, being nervous about at some point in their careers.
Yeah. I would actually say that that question, even though it's important, it's not the question that really, it's not the $1 million question. For example, you can actually test pretty well if your game is fun or not. That is not necessarily a problem. It might take a little bit longer than you expected and those kind of things. But if you are a good listener and you're honest with yourself and you play a lot of games yourself, you will find enough resources to find out if your game is fun or not. The problem, however, is way more if it's appealing or not.
Yes.
And that is a really, really hard question, because that's actually a mix between design and art and marketing, actually.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, this is another 2-hour topic right here with the state of game marketing and promotions.
We keep touching those topics, Josh.
Yeah. And I know I can definitely tell just by telling you for the last like 20 minutes or so, Aaron, that if you didn't have to go at some point, we could probably sit here for 3-4 hours and talk.
We totally could.
Just to briefly touch on game marketing promotions. While the cast won't be up by the time we're talking, I spoke with someone who basically runs his own PR business to deal with, to talk about and work with independent developers and, you know, trying to promote their games and stuff like that. And PR, I think, it's one of those topics, again, like for students and enthusiasts, you know, someone who's just trying to come in, they don't think about that stuff. They just think, I'm going to make a great game and it's going to sell. But one of the things that I've especially learned, especially with Game Wisdom and trying to make it bigger, and what a lot of independent studios have also faced, is the fact that you need someone who understands PR. There's just too many people out there doing similar things to what you're doing. to really stand out otherwise.
Yeah, that's certainly true. I think, although I have to say that that for games, because I mean, making a website or maintaining a website is, I think, even harder than to really stand out in compared to making a game. Because to take another example from a game that is also made in the Netherlands, partially, Kingdom. I don't know if you
familiar. Is that the side-scrolling game?
Yeah, that one. Those are basically two guys, and even though they played some smart moves, I don't know if they had a big marketing push or something. They had a free version online on Newgrounds and those kind of things, but they were actually just doing their thing, I think, for the most of part, just like we were mostly just doing our thing with Reus. So yes, you do those PR moves really help, but I think that the most important thing is that people will see you, and that's Steam kind of can help you a lot with that. And it has to be like that one appealing image that people say, like, I really want to click this and I really want to see the trailer. And if that works, you don't need to hire a big marketing team or something. To give an example, for Reus, we had only Manuel working for the PR. And he did a pretty good job, but he has a limited reach because he also had to program stuff and those kind of things. And for Renowned Explorers, we actually hired a marketing agency. And they worked really hard, but it was a lot harder to sell Renowned Explorers than it was to sell Reus, purely because of the image it was shown and the trailers that we had. So even though those things are important, I think the marketing really starts at the design and the appeal of the game. If that doesn't work, it's going to be extremely hard to sell your game. And if that works, it's going to be a lot easier to sell the game.
Yeah. And what's also, I think, really impacting these days has definitely been the rise of the YouTube and the Let's Play generation. If we're seeing a lot more with strategies being built around getting a hold of people like Markiplier, PewDiePie, and I know I follow a few guys, other guys as well, and when it works, you can get, you know, your game in front of who knows how many people. But, you know, they hate your game or something like that. You know, it's just like you basically just cut your game off at the knees there.
Yeah. And Epic Games were basically saved by Total Biscuit. Because the games were of the sales were going really slow, and then Total Biscuit covered it in end of October or somewhere around there, and that's when it started to work. We really needed that authority to tell people that the game was fun. Since that moment, we tenfolded, not in that month exactly, but from that moment on, we tenfolded the sales. And that's that shows indeed the importance of those YouTubers. They are the new authorities on a lot of on the game press. So yeah, that's you're absolutely right. Those things are important. And we didn't really try to cater towards it, but I'm really happy that someone picked it up.
Yeah, and going back to Game Wisdom, I mean, that's what I've been trying to build up as well, because people have moved to video content and video information for a lot of their games. So that's why I started doing the Twitch streams. That's where the YouTube channel has come from. And it's all just a circle of trying to build all these different aspects up and hopefully get something to come out of it.
Yeah, I think that's really admirable, and it's really hard. I think the good part from Game Wisdom, why I follow it so much, is because you have a lot of well thought articles on game design, not in general, but in depth actually, and those things are really interesting. But it's more a thing of authority than it's a thing of actually information. I think Total Biscuit is one of the more informed YouTubers out there, for example, from the popular ones. But I mean, there are some guys who don't know jack about game design or something, but they get millions of views because they're an authority on a charismatic level or something like that. So it's a complicated business. And while you used to, it used to be required that you are good at, with games to write game reviews or to be an authority on games, and that's not necessarily the case anymore.
Yeah, and that's again another hour long topic right there to talk about. Trying to think about where we can go next. I do want to spend time around Alex Flores, but I want to make that our final top because I think that will just lead us straight to the end. Are there any other, I guess, I guess here's one question. Going back to what we were talking about a few minutes ago, again, with finding the appeal of your games, as you were saying, Adrian, regarding that it's easy to see if a game is fun or not, but it's harder to see whether or not it will appeal. Obviously, with Ruse and Renown Explorers, there are two games that you normally don't see in the market. Again, this goes back to your studio's credo of trying to figure out new verbs or new ways to design.
Yeah.
So with those two games, I guess, how did you, test it? Or how did you look at the market to say, will people like Ruse or will people like Renown Explorers?
I think quite a funny story because for Ruse, how it started is that Boss, a colleague of mine, another founder of Abbey Games, and I, we both started making Ruse with the idea you got a planet and you got giants and it just looks awesome, so let's just make this, you know? It was, we thought about God games having a certain appeal, of course, and that there aren't many competitors on the market if it's about God games. But the appeal was actually pretty immediate. We talked about it basically 30 seconds and we were both sold and we just started making it. Which you could say is either a really strong indicator of a good appeal or a really... weak indicator. I don't know yet. My end count is not as high to actually say something useful about it. But in contrast with Renowned Explorers, we sat together with everyone. We talked about themes. We talked about gameplay. We talked about merging things together. And I can say for certain that that's a weaker approach to finding the appeal of your game. It was a bit of a compromise about a lot of things. So for example, people like Indiana Jones, so that's cool. Yeah, but we also want to do this, and we also want to have this art style, and we also have this. So all these things coming together, the total was not greater than the sum of its parts. And that is a weaker approach to I think the appeal. I think if you have something, it will kind of stick with everyone quite immediately, and it's important to have a strong vision on it. So Reus was pretty much people doing what I said, and Renowned Explorers was a way more democratic process, which was fun for a lot of people, but it also weakened the vision of the game, and it took really long for Renowned Explorers to come together.
Yeah, and it's always difficult, especially when you are the developer of the studio behind it, and we see this with every independent studio, it's very easy to get lost in your own design and see how your game looks from the outside. When I spoke with Jeff Johnson of Sky Shines Games, we talked the whole thing about Sky Shines Bedlam and how everyone that they talked to, everyone in the studio loved the game. They were expecting big things. And then it was released and the consumer feedback was just completely opposite of what they were expecting.
Yeah. That's, I don't know. We didn't really have that problem, or when we had that problem, we kind of were expecting it already. With Ruse, we knew it didn't exactly feel like a God game. We knew it was not as good as we wanted it to be, but we had to release it anyway. So we kind of expected a certain kind of backlash, and it happened. It was less than we actually expected. I don't know. Maybe that's a culture thing. In the Netherlands, we have a very direct approach to criticism. So you're very likely to hear about people, what they don't like about your game when they test it.
Mm-hmm.
That also goes for renowned explorers. As opposed maybe to the United States, I don't know. I have the idea that in the United States, when I was there, people were a lot more polite about their criticism. I don't know. We just didn't have that problem. Maybe that's something we'll still get to in the future, or maybe we have some very clever eyes in the team that know what's going on, or maybe it's a culture thing. I really don't know.
Yeah, and I think that's another interesting topic. Is that for a lot of, for anyone, you really don't know what your game's going to do until it's finally released.
That's absolutely right. Yeah.
And we're seeing more developers go for more ways of getting the game in front of people. The whole rise of early access has been, I think, huge. It's also been very debatable among developers. I've spoken to a lot of people who love it. They want to do it for every one of their games. And then there are developers who don't want to do it, and they just want to keep to the traditional model.
Yeah. Yeah, we were also in this situation. I think in hindsight...
Mm-hmm.
No, not in hindsight, because we didn't have any money, so we had to release a game. It's pretty simple like that. But Renowned Explorers would probably have done better in early access, because there are a lot of risks.
Mm-hmm.
It is a game that is a risky buy for the consumer,
mm-hmm.
because we don't have a good name, or not a decent enough name to guarantee a sale. And Renowned Explorers, you can look at Renowned Explorers and you can think, I don't have no idea what I'm going to play.
Mm-hmm.
People are not going to buy that stuff.
Yeah.
They want to buy something that they want to play. It doesn't matter if it's good or not. They want to buy something that they want to play.
Mm-hmm.
And early access kind of softens that blow a little bit, I think, because early access gives the player a sort of hamster to rationalize, like, oh, but I can still see where the game is going and I can still influence the game as well. So maybe for Renowned Explorers, it would have been better to go early access. But other games, a lot of other games, we'll probably be better off just launching. I don't know. I don't have the data, but I can see I can understand both sides of the debate.
Yeah. And there's also the catch of early access. If your game doesn't do well, if you can't maintain that momentum, that it can also screw the game when it comes out at launch, or everyone hears about all the problem you had with early access. But
yeah,
as you're saying, Adrian, it is becoming a lot more of a popular option, especially, as you said, with games that are either experimental or you can't, you know, put like a 5-10 second pitch behind them.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a way to compensate for that weakness. I would say we're trying to avoid that experimental weakness as the plague in the future, because it's really tough to get over that. I wrote a piece for Gamma Sutra about a month after Renowned Explorers released about the price of innovation for your game.
Mm-hmm.
And someone very rightly pointed out that what we did with Renowned Explorers is not necessarily that much innovation, but more invention,
mm-hmm.
which I thought was a really good point. An invention is extremely hard to sell, and that's something that I would try to avoid in the future.
Yeah, it's again a reason why when we see popular designs and popular mechanics, that they usually become adopted by other studios.
Yeah.
I was just talking about this on Twitter the other night, but we're seeing a lot more games try to promote themselves as being Dark Souls, like, these days, because the Souls games are now so popular, but
yeah,
more importantly,
become staple.
Yeah, but more importantly to the audience, they know what to expect. When you say my game's like Call of Duty, they have a good idea what that's going to mean. When you
it's spot on. That's exactly the
mm-hmm.
the sentiment that we're having as well. We were just incredibly lucky to have Total Biscuit cover the game.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, you played as well. I really think Renowned Explorers became a pretty good game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it could have been my last game.
I know.
And I'm very well aware of that. And that is something that kind of changed my perspective on things. I was always trying to be as interesting as possible, try to do as many as risk as possible, mm-hmm. because I kind of felt like I was capable enough to pull off a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
But that is not how the world turns.
Mm-hmm.
And things like early access might really help you in getting it better out there. But the fact remains what you just said about Dark Souls being a marketing verb for you to tag your game on. That is something that we totally missed. And I will probably try to pitch my next game as it's game X,
mm-hmm.
but with Y, you know?
Yeah, and that's something that I wrote about on a post like a few weeks ago regarding trying to make your game original versus making something that's a clone. But you don't want to chase people. You don't want to say, I'm making the next Dark Souls or I'm making the next Call of Duty. You want to say, I'll make a game that's like Dark Souls, but it does so and so and so. Because at least when they hear like the name of the game, they can at least start to compartmentalize, you know, what your game's going to be about. Someone says, oh, your game's going to be like Spelunky. Then I'm imagining it's going to be like a 2D style game. Or
I think it's even more complicated than that. Mm-hmm. Complicated?
Yeah.
I don't even think, if I would say it's like XCOM with The Sims,
mm-hmm.
it would still be really hard for someone to put a tag on that, to know what to expect. So I think, like, if you talk about the recent successful indie games,
mm-hmm.
Undertale, Stardew Valley, they have one thing in common.
Mm-hmm.
They are, in a certain form, a pretty hard copy of a popular game that is unavailable for a really long time.
Yeah. Well, definitely. I mean,
That's something that I think is a way more interesting, because it's actually the opposite of interesting, but way more lucrative approach
mm-hmm.
and towards making games. Well, something like Superhot, which also did pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they are still comparable. It's still a shooter, you know. So I think it's very important that the potential buyer, the potential gamer, has a very strong picture of what he's going to do.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be right, but he has to have a strong picture.
Yeah. And with early access, that's where you can really get that good idea, especially with the fact that they're a little bit more lax about return policy with early access compared to the retail.
Yeah.
And that's one of the very interesting side discussions we can have about the state of the digital market these days, with more and more people wanting like that return policy. And I think that's definitely a topic that's way too big to get into at this point. But I do want to touch on what you were just saying a few seconds ago regarding developers who are basically trying to figure out what was popular and what's missing and how can I approach that. The other option is to just really hit it out of the park, I think, with marketing or with something that you know is going to be a hard sell, but you build it up. And I think Darkest Dungeon was a really good example of that. When they spent, I think, 6 months preparing the Kickstarter, the trailers, the videos, etc. And when they went on to Kickstarter, they didn't have any gameplay footage. They just had, you know, one amazing, I think it was like a 2-minute pitch video. So with that, yes, we didn't see exact gameplay, but we got a pretty good idea of what that game was going to entail.
Yeah, that's true. I still think Darkest Dungeon has some a very recognizable points.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can see the kind of JRPG battle style, and you are a fan of H.P. Lovecraft,
mm-hmm.
then it's gonna hit home, you know?
Exactly.
That's the point. It doesn't necessarily have to be a clone of a game,
mm-hmm.
or have to be strongly based on a game. It just has to look recognizable in one way or another,
mm-hmm.
be it the theme or be it the especially the screenshots that you can see, like, oh, I'm gonna basically play Civilization, I guess, or I'm gonna basically play a JRPG
mm-hmm.
thing in H.P. Lovecraft.
Mm-hmm.
that's enough for a lot of people. And I think you also hit a good point on early access, that early access also concentrates people who are willing to actually take a risk.
Definitely.
Right? Because there's only a small part of the market. Mm-hmm. And they can actually help build up that that hype.
Mm-hmm.
For example, like Undertale.
Yeah.
And it's easier to target them. So I think you have there's certainly something very interesting about Kickstarter and early access if you're wanting to take some risks with your design choices.
Yeah. And again, this is a good hour plus discussion. There's always like that risk of early access. And again, this goes back to what you were saying a few minutes ago, Adrian, and trying to get the game's appeal or the game's message across to people. If you release your game at the wrong state, if you release it too early, then people think you haven't done anything or this is what the game's going to be like and I don't want to play it. You release it too late, and yes, you have something, but let's say someone finds something really bad or a really good improvement, but if your game's already halfway through its beta, you can't really add that in. And I think this goes back to something that we've talked multiple times on the podcast about, and getting like the core foundation of your game settled. What is your main feedback loop of play? And if you can get that done, you can get that perfected, you can go onto early access and say, this is what my game's going to be about. If you like this little segment, you're going to love, you know, when this game is done in, let's say, 6 months or a year or whatever.
Yeah.
A really good example of that recently would be Duskers by Misfits Attic. They approached early access with a game that I think was a very hard sale, a dirty tech programming-based roguelike. Very minimalistic, but that core feedback from day one was good. The people who wanted that experience, and just as you said, Adrian, they went for something that people wanted, but that doesn't necessarily was available.
Yeah.
And no matter how much Duskers changed, no matter what they added or grew or altered, it still went back to that core feedback or to that original concept that people wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And again,
there's nothing to add.
And again, this has definitely been a great conversation, and we've spent the last almost 50 minutes just talking about game industry and game dev, and we could probably spend another hour or 2 hours easily on this.
Easily.
I mean, this is reminding me of those casts I've had with like Chris Park or John Schaefer. When we get rolling, it's very hard to stop. But I know you have to get going, and at some point I need to start my day too. So we'll move on, and this will definitely not be the last time we talk. I would love to have you back.
Yeah,
on.
I would love to talk another time as well, yeah.
But for today, let's talk more about Renowned Explorers. I've definitely had my fair share of talking about between the posts on the site and the numerous videos I've made on it and streamed. I'm running a mock or impromptu challenge with Tom Chick and Jason McMaster of Core to 3. And right now I'm in first place, so that's good. At least at the time of this recording.
Yeah, you're the champion because you got better last time when you started playing, right? Yeah. Because of with Manuel. So
yeah, he gave you all
good
the
job.
Tips and the tricks. And even though we're only going to spend maybe 15, 20 minutes on, I mean, again, the game is such an interesting beast. We could probably dedicate an entire cast to talk about all the design and implementation.
Well, thanks.
And again, that's why I love the game and why I made my 2015. And this goes back to what we were just talking about. It's a game that you really don't see anyone else doing this. And that's both for good and for bad, as we've seen. It's good because it's unique. And if it scratches that itch, you're going to love it. But it is a hard sell. And that's something that we're seeing a lot from the independent space as well. These games that are designed around being pretty much a razor-focused niche. And sometimes there's an audience, and unfortunately we've seen cases where sometimes it's not an audience.
Yeah.
I guess to start this topic then, I know this is, as I said earlier in the cast, is a theme that's hard to explain, but how would you, I guess, pitch Renowned Explorers to someone listening to this cast right now?
I would say it's a strategic exploration game, which already is a hard start to begin with, where you gather a cast of explorers who have very strong own characters, and you go out to explore the world, find treasures, and beat your rival, and that in a more roguelike setting. You see how horrible this pitch is?
I know. I'm glad that you did, because I would probably butcher it too.
Yeah, and we're even missing the point of like being able to use diplomacy on a tactical map and those kind of things. But that is, here lies the problem of Renowned Explorers. You can't sell it like that. It's horrible.
It's a game that you have to see to believe. But even but that is, of course, making it even harder to sell. Again, like I could, if I say to someone, "This game's like Dark Souls," that will pretty much light up a lot of faces right there.
Exactly.
Now, with Renowned Explorers, again, this also makes it very tricky to examine, because not only is it a very complicated game, it's a multi-system based game, something similar to XCOM. Where it's not just one thing you're doing. You have the overworld map. You have research. You have, of course, a tactical layer. These are all different yet interconnected. And again, we can easily spend each one of these questions, I think, could have like a 30-minute answer. But I guess, I know right here this could probably take us over time, but I gotta ask, where did the original concept for the game come from?
Chaos, because as I mentioned before, when we started making Renowned Explorers, actually is a pretty funny story. When we started making Renowned Explorers, we were pretty convinced of this democratic way of creating a game. And at that point, we were with, I think, 9 people. Who were working and brainstorming on making a game. And the consequence of that was that I sat down with, I think, Boss and Dennis, who was another game designer at that time who worked with us. And we got like this idea rolling of an exploration game with gathering a crew. I'm a big, big fan of indirect type of games like Football Managers or those kind of things where you... kind of give orders, but the AI has to do it by themselves, you know? And we got this ball rolling about exploration game. But what happened next is very typical for, I think, democratic constitutions in general, is that someone started asking, "Oh, that sounds pretty neat. Oh, it would be super cool if this was added," you know?
Yes.
And then it's like, "Yeah, sure, let's do that." And then there was this artist who was making really cool character art. And they were like, "Okay, let's add that as well." And we got like this steaming pile of chaos. And it really took, I think, 9 months before the game actually was going somewhere. Because we were so busy with both on the technical side and on the creative side to just mash things together and hope for the best, but it was complete chaos. It was the idea was kind of a cute way from saying like a Jules Verne exploration world with strategy, and before we knew it, there were like important characters and there were like handmade maps and there was all these kind of things, 3 different layers, 4 different layers, 2 different layers. That's it. Yeah, that's how it kind of started. And then with a lot of hard work and cutting and mending, we kind of got to Renowned Explorers.
And again, there's just so much to pick apart with this game. I'm sort of in that state that I'm like shocked. I don't know what part to focus on first, because there's just so much here. I mean, we even mentioned the whole abstraction layer of how emotion can do damage, and then the adventure wheel roll. I guess I definitely want to go back to that, but keeping with what you said regarding this kind of chaos of development and just adding, removing, and essentially just like stitching something together like a Frankenstein monster.
Yeah.
I guess, as you said earlier in the cast regarding finding the fun or finding out when is this game, you know, when you have something, when you have that aha moment with Renowned Explorers, I guess, when did that happen? When was the point when you said, okay, we have something, let's now take this and try and sell it, or let's try and, you know, use this as our foundation?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think there are a few important moments, and those moments are depending on which risks we're talking about. So for example, about a year in development, when we made the first few events, you know, like little stories, because that was kind of an accident, because I'm not a native speaker in English, and nobody is. So making a game which has like 150,000 words is, for someone like me, I would say like, no, that's crazy work. We're not going to do that. But we got at a point in development that we had to do that to actually fill up the voids that we created by throwing things away. So a bit hard pressured, we made those things. And that's about a year in development. And there were a few events and there were some battles. And those battles weren't worked out as they are right now. And there were items, I remember. And that's the point where we really started thinking like, okay, this is actually going somewhere. But to be fair, we should have killed the project 2 or 3 months in if we were keen on our money. Because that's way and way and way too late. A year in is, then we got like another year to actually finish the game. It was complete madness. I worked myself to death in that period. A lot of things in my personal life suffered under it. It shouldn't have been happening like that. We got really lucky, and I'm also lucky that I'm not. I actually got even a stress attack at some moment that an ambulance had to come over to check on me, because it was not fun working on it for a long period of time. But it took about a year before things finally started looking upwards.
And that is definitely one of the darker sides of game development. Something that a lot of people, again, going back to enthusiasts and students, that they don't hear about. And part of the reason is that there is no quote-unquote guide to making a game. Everyone has their own process. Every studio is different. So you can't just consult with someone and say, okay, how do I make my roguelike strategy board game-esque title? No one's going to help you with that. And a lot of it is just you having to figure things out on your own. And
yeah absolutely. And another very important part on this is the feedback is so slow. It takes very long to make a game, so you have to have a lot of discipline and open eyes,
definitely, and
to get there.
And especially as an independent studio, when you guys, you said you were, are you seven, you said 7 or 9, I think.
At the moment, yeah, seven.
I mean, that's not enough people to have a game testing pool. And again, when you have 7 people, or when you said you grew up to like about 15 or so during, you know, full scale development, that's still not enough to get a variety of eyes on your game. And as you just said, Adrian, the feedback is so critical, yet it's something that is missing when you're trying to design a game. You just said that it took you about a year or so just to get to a point where you have something you can say, okay, now let's build it.
I would like to split that feedback moment, though, in 2 things for clarity. Because on one hand, you have the feedback of the quality of the game, which I think is a little bit easier to get. What I said before, it's easier to see if your game is fun. It's hard to see if you're going to make it or not. And that second part, that's the feedback that you're missing for a very long time.
And it's one of the things that I've spoken with Chris Park from Ark and Games about. One of the things that he said, especially when you're designing these multiple system games, is the fact that when you're building a game that's really like 3 or 4 separate games into one, the feedback is just impossible to get until you design all those systems. You don't know.
Absolutely.
Like, imagine, like, go back to, like, the original XCOM, for instance. You can't just test the game at the Geoscape layer and say, oh, this game's great, we're going to sell it.
You have
base building, you have tactical, and as I think you're well aware of, those things just don't magically appear you're not just going to design them all in 1 week and then go to testing. It takes absolutely a very long time.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Soren Johnson, when he worked on Spore, he actually made a very good piece about how there's only one valid prototype, and that is the game itself. There is no such thing, indeed, as splitting the game in four or three, testing one thing and say, okay, yeah, this is good, this is greenlit, because that's exactly what happened in Spore. You get all those different mini games and they just stick it together and then it doesn't work, you know?
Oh, yeah, so, definitely.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's the reason why a game like Renown Explorers is comes together so late in the development process.
Definitely. And again, this goes back to what you were saying earlier in the cast. Why developers like test, or I'm sorry, like why AAA publishers and developers like tested mechanics and genres? They have a foundation. They know, okay, this is what Call of Duty is. So we know it's made up of this, this, and this. So we
You know what kind of controls you need, what's important to look at, those kind of things. Absolutely.
And you can then grow things out. Again, make it your own. So you can say, my game's like Call of Duty with this model, but we're doing this so and so differently. But when you're building something entirely from scratch, like we see with a lot of independent studios these days, you don't have that support system. You don't have, you can't show this game to people, or you can't say, okay, well, this studio did an emotional based tactical system, let's follow them.
Yeah, exactly. That is, and a lot of, I'm actually also surprised of game developers underestimating this. From Renowned Explorers, there are some people who are pretty easy to say, like, it's like they just made an RPG and they tag different names on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not.
Yeah.
It really isn't. There is a lot more going on. And I understand players not necessarily seeing it because they don't have the...
Mm-hmm.
It's not their job to see it that way. But yeah, a lot of game developers also don't necessarily see it as well.
Mm-hmm. And trying to work on a game like that is just, you know, immensely challenging. As a good example, I've been trying to follow John Schaefer with his game, At the Gates.
Yeah,
and
big fan of John Schaefer, by the way.
Yeah, me too. I would love to get him back on the cast. I just don't know what he's doing right now. He's disappeared. He's such in, like, development mode that it's hard to get any real updates. And again, when you're working on something entirely original, you're not only designing things, you're also having to figure them all out from scratch. And that, you know, magnifies the work and definitely the stress level. And
absolutely. And it makes the game harder to sell. So there is a lot of downsides on doing this.
Yeah, and I don't want to name names because I don't want to point them out, but I've spoken to a few developers previously through email and stuff like that who also had the chaotic approach, you know, trying to build a game at the same time you're essentially inventing new systems and mechanics. And a few of those developers ran into a lot of trouble. And I don't want to say who they were, but I mean, it's definitely great that Renown Explorers succeed and you guys are able to do it. But I think, as you said, if from a business perspective, this was pretty much one of those giant red flags, don't do this.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I want to stress again how extremely lucky we got with the coverage from Total Biscuit, because I think it's madness almost that you make something and you're really proud of what you made and it's a good game and almost everyone who plays it likes it. It has still has a very high Steam rating and those kind of things. And it just doesn't sell.
Yeah. I mean, hell, again, as I said earlier in the cast, we can also compare that to the film industry and even a lot of legendary filmmakers who their careers, they may have, like, they may make really great movies that stand the test of time, but those things could also be giant commercial flops.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. The game I would think about is Psychonauts, for example, kind of the same problem. And, the thing is, those games, if they're really good, they will get their attention eventually.
Yeah.
But it might be too late.
Exactly. And that's...
In our case, we got super, super lucky. And same goes for Double Fine. But Yeah, that's very, it's a very edgy thing to balance. Yeah.
I remember hearing stories about Killer 7 by Suda51. Have you heard of this game?
Yeah.
And an insane game. We don't have the time to talk about what it is now, but he, I think, gave an interview where he said that the game didn't actually start selling or didn't start making money until like a year after it was released.
Yeah.
And for like enthusiasts and people outside the industry, they don't think that's such a bad thing. But when you're an independent studio or hell, any studio, if you're waiting months and months to hopefully see if you actually make a profit,
when there's a mortgage,
yeah,
covering your, it's absolutely terrifying. Mm-hmm. I think it's one of the most, yeah, probably one of the most stressful things I've ever experienced.
Yeah, and I think the problem, especially the misconception, is that when you see a game like Undertale or Stardew Valley and you hear that it does amazingly well and you think, oh, I can do just that as well, there's just so many factors that go into not just making a game and designing it, but again, selling the game, making sure it's appealing. And
yeah.
I mean, again, this is a too big a conversation I have right now, but the video game industry is a very risky business, and sometimes a great game gets lucky, like with Renowned Explorers or Stardew Valley. But then I've also had cases where I've seen amazing games that I love just tank completely, and the developer goes out of business.
Yeah, yeah. It's something to keep in mind when you're making your own game.
Mm-hmm. For
it
sure.
It can go wrong really bad.
Mm-hmm. But to hopefully try and at least get some semblance of a topic, let's go back to Renowned Explorers, at least for a few minutes. There's just so much we can talk about with this game. It's not even fun. as we've said, it took a while for the game to click, again, thanks to the multiple system design.
Yeah.
One thing that I found that was very interesting, again, was the abstraction at the heart of the game. A lot of the decisions, a lot of the story and the lore is built on abstracting these elements, whether it's abstracting the encounter roles or the adventure wheel role,
yeah,
or how different encounters play out, whether you're friendly or devious or aggressive. And I know this question is an easy hour right here, but if you can hopefully give the
a short version.
Where did like this layer of abstraction come from when you were designing the game?
I think the layer of abstraction is something that is very inherent in my view of games,
mm-hmm,
in general. When I'm playing a fighting game, I'm very well aware that I'm pressing buttons,
mm-hmm,
to make something do some damage, which is absolutely not realistic.
Yeah.
JRPGs being the perfect example, for you have like this guy with a huge ass sword, and
mm-hmm,
you have to bash 500 times against some other small human before it actually goes down. So I'm very well aware that a lot of good games have a lot of appeal,
mm-hmm,
because abstraction allows for interesting choices.
Mm-hmm.
So I already was biased towards those abstractions, and the second part which came for me was, first, what is the abstraction for diplomacy that I can improve? And the encounter system roll out of that. And the second one, what is the abstraction for explory actions,
mm-hmm,
that you would do during an expedition? And the adventure wheel and the tokens roll out of that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's very inherent to my view of games to use abstraction. Maybe a bit too much, but it's certainly... It gives a strong basis for very strong choice-based gameplay.
Yeah. And one of the things I really do like about Renowned Explorers is that even though there is that massive layer of abstraction over all the systems, it all fits within the lore or the setting that you've set up for the game. For instance, you don't have health, you have spirit or morale. So
yeah,
it makes sense that you can talk to someone and hurt them because you're breaking their spirit. Instead of, you know, some kind of match where, you know, you talk and you do 20 points of damage.
Yeah.
Or
You should have seen me working on those kind of things. It took months
yeah
to get there. But Yeah, because you have to like mix all the combinations and see if it makes sense. Like, does it make sense that you talk to someone friendly 4 or 5 times and then punch them and that they're dead, even though it's Maria giving a slap, you know? Mm-hmm. And then if you have to rationalize that that works, you can, because that's also how the player probably sees it. It's like, mm-hmm. oh, yeah, because I talked to him and he was totally trusting me. So when I slapped him, I really got to his heart and then he fell down in mm-hmm. complete betrayal or something like that, you know?
Yeah. And then it becomes harder to win them back because how are they going to trust you again when you just punch them in the face?
Exactly, exactly. I think there's one that I'm not very happy with, and that's the enrage emotion, because enraging someone out of an encounter is just not very intuitive. Mm-hmm. I mean, scaring them away or humiliating them so they run away is pretty self-explaining, but mm-hmm. enraged with... Yeah, too much enraged. I think we made it work sort of, but it's one of those little black dots in the design that I didn't really get to the point of it. So that's also kind of shows how complicated it was to get to the system.
Yeah. And I'm blanking because there's just too many things for us to talk about this game. But one thing that I definitely wanted to touch on again, we sort of mentioned this during Ruse, and that was the art style for Renown Explorers. You mentioned the name of the artist earlier. Could you say that again?
It's Marlies, which is a girl. Marlies Barents, but it's a Dutch name, so it's a bit hard to... I'll put it in chat later so you could... put it down.
Yeah, and I just want to talk about it at least briefly, because I know we are starting to run long, but I guess how did Marlies approach, I guess, the art style for Renown Explorers? As I said, everyone, I even said this in my original review, that I just love how, I wouldn't say it's striking, but it's distinctive, the art style of the game. Like, you look at someone like Maria, or Ivan, or even Ravalu, I mean, these characters... Even though they don't say anything in the traditional sense, you can just get like their entire attitude just by looking at them. It reminds me really a lot of the work that went into the Team Fortress character models and how.
Yeah, that's big inspiration as well. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna have to expand a little bit more on this because there are three very distinctive parts of the art that were done by three different people who had a very big impact on them. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the overall vibe of Reus and Renown Explorers, mm-hmm. that is really Marlies doing, mm-hmm. the colorful way of the game and cheerful atmosphere. That is just Marlies. And it's not how did Marlies approach this to making games. It's more like how did we approach to getting to Marlies, because we saw in Marlies a lot of raw characteristic power that we really wanted to use. So we kind of tried to make things fit a little bit together. It's not, of course, she also had a lot of work to think out how things should look like, but it was actually a little bit the other way around. We recognized the talent and raw character that was in her style, and that is something that we wanted to keep. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, the characters are made actually by another artist, Peter Klein, and he is just great with characters, and he made a lot of mock-ups, and that's what I said before, like that there was a moment that somebody made really cool characters and we thought now we have to make a game with a lot of characters in it. That was just Peter Klein's doing. He just made a lot of cool characters, and we couldn't just leave that talent hanging. We had to use it because that's what we had at that moment. And the animations is actually an intern to give an idea of how chaotic maybe the whole thing was an intern, Carmen van Sleeuwen. Mm-hmm. And she really made those animations go to the next level and really... breathe their character. I think Maria is a really good example. I think that's one of the first ones she did. She cleaned up a lot of characters. She cleaned up Agatha, but almost all animations that are in game are based on a lot of characteristics that she introduced into the team. So it was in this case, it's really a team effort to get it all together.
Cool. And it's kind of interesting to hear that, especially the fact that it took three artists to make this just one unique style of Renown Explorers.
Yeah.
Was that something similar to what happened with Ruse, or is that just the one artist?
No, Ruse is different. Oh. Ruse and Renown Explorers have two very, very different approaches on making games. Ruse was very dictatorial in the way the game was made. Mm-hmm. I was the one who had the most time at hand. So I basically dictated what's going to happen. And I sat down with Marlies, because Marlies also worked on Ruse. And we came to the style that the game has. But everything was sort of controlled by me in a certain kind of way. In Renown Explorers, we just had those people. I couldn't hire more people. I couldn't say like, oh, we actually need a 3D artist. Oh, actually, we need an artist that does more like this or more like that.
Mm-hmm.
We did not have that choice. We had that choice in Ruse, but after Ruse, we went on a hiring spree, unwisely, but we did. So we were with a certain group of people with certain skills, and those skills, the pure character of the people working on the game determined the style of the game, and it was a lot of work to put it all together. And I think Carmen, the intern at that time, she was the one who really put everything, the last pieces together. But it certainly took a lot of time to get there.
Yeah, and especially with the art and the aesthetic, that's, wow, that's another 30, 40 minutes topic right there. But it's one of the things that's, again, becoming a lot more important, especially for selling your game. We mentioned this earlier in the cast regarding finding the appeal or finding something for the audience to attach themselves to.
Yeah.
And sometimes that is simply the art. With Darkest Dungeon, for instance, that 2-minute trailer showing that art style.
Very important, yes.
And I can also go back to Play Entertainment with, like, Don't Starve and Invisible Ink. And this also goes back to even further what we talked about originally in the cast, with the studio becoming its own brand. And part of that is having not so much a stylized art style, but having something distinctive, that someone sees this game and says, that's a game from Abbey Games. Or that's something from Clay Entertainment, etc.
Yeah, that is certainly something that we are chasing. I think it will be a lot easier to sell our third game, giving Renowned Explorers and Rius. And if I'm almost 100% sure we're going to keep our style, because that's just important for the future.
Yeah, definitely. And it's all about building that brand. And
exactly.
Man, I think we've touched on like 8 different topics that could be like hour-long cast. And
we're so interesting today, Josh.
I know. It's killing me because I do want to just spend the day talking to you, but I'm sure the folks will get tired of that, and I know our voice will probably cut out. And there's also the fact that there's the time difference. For those of you, obviously, as we said, Adrian is in the Netherlands right now. I'm East Coast United States, so I think there's like a... What is it, like a 7-8 hour difference between us or something like that?
What's the time right now?
It is 4:30 my time right now.
4:30 is a 6, I think, yeah.
Okay.
6 or 5 hours.
Oof, yeah.
6 hours. Six.
And it's always great to have these conversations too, and it does energize us, but again, there's just so much I want to talk to you about with this.
I guess we're going to have a second...
Second
meeting.
Definitely. Trying to think if there's anything we can touch on, at least quickly, with Renown Explorers. Again, there's just so much here. I mean, hell, I won't ask you about like balancing the characters, but who knows how long that will take to go.
Oh, that's a big topic as well.
I guess... At least to start to wrap things up, and again, I will definitely want to have you back on again in the future, probably sooner than later, Adrian.
I'm honored.
But I think one topic I definitely want to ask you about, at least sort of to end this topic, is finishing a game of Round Explorers. Again, this is another very unique part of the game. You have, at least in the score-based mode, you choose 5 expeditions, and then wherever the chips fall, that's your quote-unquote adventure. And you've, of course, with the Mord Explorer expansion, you've added in a second, I guess, quote-unquote endgame level. But with ending a game of Round Explorers, where did that whole process come from?
That's another very interesting question. An observant listener would have seen that if they both played Renowned Explorers and Reus, is that they actually have the same philosophy of ending a game. Reus had more of a time limit, and you could see Renowned Explorers of having a sort of a turn limit, right?
Yeah.
And the idea behind that is that to make a game approachable in a certain kind of way, but still give a lot of challenge, you can't just like put all the expeditions one behind another and say just go to the end and finish the game, because a lot of people will fail on their third or fifth expedition, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and will lead to certain kind of frustration-based gameplay. I'm nothing against frustration-based gameplay. I love a lot of those games, but it's not, it doesn't really resonate with the more open and inviting atmosphere that the game has. Same goes for Reus. If you would have a hard fail with a lot of things, then it wouldn't be so inviting to play as a newcomer. Now I can basically, even though Renowned Explorers is kind of complicated to really grasp entirely, you would be fascinated by how easy a lot of people pick it up, because it's, if you're losing, you can just go to a lower difficulty, or you could do discovery mode, or you could just do only 2 or 3 star expeditions, and then you will probably be overpowered for them. Same goes for Reus. You could only get 1 achievement every time you're doing the game, or you could be getting 5 to 7 if you're really good at the game. And the philosophy behind that is that openness for newcomers, for players to experience the game at their own pace, which sounds totally crazy when you're talking about time limits or turn limits, but that's exactly what is happening at that point, while still providing a challenge.
Yeah.
That's kind of the philosophy behind it.
And that goes with sort of what I was talking about in the post I just put up today at the time of this recording regarding difficulty settings and games, and how some of the best difficulties are those that are essentially a part of the design or the mechanics versus just an abstracted, you know, easy, medium, hard, expert. And
yeah,
now Explorers is definitely an example of the former there. With, again, each expedition is entirely 100% designed uniquely. You'll never see the same situations of the Highlands in the Emerge Island or Mali.
Yeah.
And as you just said, Adrian, it lets players essentially define their own path. And when you get good at the game, you can basically do each, you know, star in progression expedition. You could go 1, 2, 3, 4, all the way to Shangri-La or the Lost Island. But if someone is struggling, and in some of my games I play, there are cases where I see that this party just is not doing well. So I can, so I know maybe I need to do an easier expedition or try to approach things differently. And the quote-unquote end of Renowned Explorers is definitely left up there just in terms of the 2,500 renown that you need to win. Yeah. So however you get that, you'll technically win the game. But there's, of course, that push to keep going or to find new stuff, especially with Shangri-La. And I can't even count all the time ahead right now how many different ending structures you can get there based on how you play the game.
Exactly. Yeah, and that also gives the game a very high skill cap, which is really fun. Not many new players. Oh, that's also a thing with difficulty. I think the difficulty setting is more of a marketing tool than it is actually
design.
Difficulty tool?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because the problem we had, we didn't ship with difficulties. We kind of assumed that people would go on easier expeditions if they were feeling that they were in a tough spot, but that's not how people work. They see a one star, then they want to do a two star, then they want to do a three star, then they want to do 4 and 5. That's what the first thing that they're going to do. And the difficulty setting allows people to actually shift a little bit and experiment a little bit more until they're more feel safer for picking 2 3-star expeditions, for example.
Yeah.
And so that's one part. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I definitely spoke about it with Manuel when we did the live stream. I think it was like a week or so ago. And how one of the things about Renown Explorer is that it is a very challenging game to pick up. And that's just in part by the fact that you have these multiple systems all interacting with each other. And we can, again, frame this back to what we talked about earlier with trying to sell Renown Explorer to someone. It's very hard when you have all these different things. I mean, I was just thinking about this with how they marketed XCOM Enemy Unknown. Like, if XCOM was, if Enemy Unknown was just its own unique thing, like there was no previous game to talk about, I think that would have been a much harder sell. Because you don't have that foundation. That's the same thing with Renown Explorers. There's no other game we can point to and say,
Look,
exactly.
That's the game, yeah.
Now, again, we are getting close to the hour and a half mark, so we are going, I know you have to get going in a few minutes.
Yeah, exactly, you have to wrap it up.
Yeah, so I think it's time to move on and start to wrap things up. And again, we can spend, I don't even want to know how long we could spend talking today on this cast, but I can feel my voice starting to croak. I know you have to get going. Again, it's like 6 hours ahead where you are, so I'm sure you need to get some sleep. So
exactly.
To wrap up the cast, I do want to talk just briefly about the future, or I guess maybe even the short-term future for Abbey Games.
Yes.
When I spoke with Manuel on the live stream, I did pose a question of what's next for Abbey and what's next for Renown Explorers. I know he said that in terms of Renown Explorers, a lot of what's going to happen with the game is going to be dependent upon, obviously, game sales.
Yeah.
So I guess for you then, Adrian, how do you see, I guess...
Give you another update.
Yeah.
Well, for certain is that we're going to go patch the... Or give another 2 patches this summer. They will be about balance, but there will also probably be new content, because that's really cool, and we like to make that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. We also really have to start thinking about a new game. So that's gonna be important, but I think we'll have an opportunity to maybe bring more content to Renown Explorers with DLC or something. It's really something I'm lobbying for to make it happen.
Yeah.
It won't be an expansion probably, because those things are very hard and expensive to make.
Mm-hmm.
Probably, but it could be like a set of new characters, new locations, those kind of things would be, I give them a chance that they will exist. I'm not promising you anything, because that's not my place to do, but it has a decent chance.
Yeah, and again, I mean, we didn't even get to the more to explore content in this cast. Again, that's, who knows how long it would take us to go over that. I guess I gotta ask, have you started giving like thoughts? Do you have any like slight ideas of what the third game will be from Abbey Games, or is it still too soon to say at this point?
It's too soon to say. We have a lot of very interesting concepts, but it's too soon to say. I would be very glad to talk to you about if I talk about it with you, but I have nothing to talk about.
Awesome. So. And again, it's been a fantastic conversation with you today, Adrian.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's definitely enough topics here we could easily have a part 2 and probably even a part 3 cast. And I'd love to have my contributor James on, because I think he would love to talk to you as well. And again, for those listening, this was sort of like a spur of the moment. We missed the original time, or I missed the original time, and we just decided, let's just have a casual chat later, and it turned into this. And again, it could turn into a 3-4 hour cast if we're not careful. All right. So, again, even though we're going to wrap things up now, it's definitely not going to be the end of our talk. And definitely keep in touch through email. And when you have any more free time, I would love to talk to you again.
Absolutely. Me too.
So, with all that said, we're going to end things here for this episode of the Perceptive Podcast. Again, I definitely want to thank you, Adrian, for coming on. And as I said, I really do wish you guys the best of luck with Renowned Explorers. And
thanks. Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot for having me as well.
Yeah. And whatever your third idea may be. And I'm crossing my fingers it won't be a year of chaos and development for that one.
Yeah, I'm crossing my fingers too.
Awesome. For those of you listening, we're going to end things here. As always, if you'd like to support Game Wisdom, there are multiple options available. First, if you'd like to submit a guest piece for the site or be a future podcast guest, you can find information and links under Submissions Wanted. I'm always looking for new guests and contributors, be it students, enthusiasts, members of the industry, whatever. Definitely shoot me an email, josh@game-wisdom.com. If you'd like to check out the video content on the site, you can find me on YouTube as well as Twitch. There are links to both on the front page. There's always going to be daily content and usually daily streaming as well. You can follow me on Twitter under GWBicer to get the latest updates when content goes live, as well as random thoughts from me throughout the day. And last but not least, you can find me on Patreon under Game Wisdom. Any donations will be greatly appreciated in order to secure the monthly funding that I need to keep going, as well as provide you guys with some more content, including developer roundtable casts and longer streams. If you enjoyed this cast and would like a copy of it for your own library, the new $20 reward is a digital CD of the cast of that month. So definitely check that out. So again, thanks so much for tuning in to this episode of the Perceptive Podcast. Special shout out to those of you listening to this on YouTube, as well as hopefully Google Play and iTunes at some point in the near future. Anyway, thanks again. Have a great rest of the week, and we will talk to you again next time.